Please stand by as we're about to begin. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the IBM Accelerate Alumni Conference. As a reminder, today's call is being recorded. To ask a question today on our conference, please press star one on your telephone keypad, and we'll take your question as soon as possible. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Ms. Pat Neal. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Abe. And good morning, Albert. I think you're our sole participant at this time. How are you today?
Good.
This is Pat Neal, Albert, and I'd like to welcome you to our first Accelerate Alumni call. This is a pilot call that we're running, and we're planning to offer further calls during 2009. And the objectives of these follow-on calls are to continue to reinforce the skills that were learned in the class and to share specific executive perspectives on some of the key topics relevant to sellers. So we're going to be really interested in your input or your feedback, Albert. And on the line with me are Mark Meyer and Don Margotta, who's also from Northeastern University. So since you're our only participant, Albert, you're going to have a lot of opportunity to ask questions and make comments. And we actually did run a fairly active call this morning, and there were a few participants that were very vocal, and they had some good questions and brought up some good comments, so we enjoyed that. So if there's anything that you want to ask, just please feel free to jump in. So now the other thing I wanted to mention, Albert, is that the web conference is not coming up. I'm not sure if you've tried to go into it.
Say it again?
The web conference facility?
Yeah.
Doesn't seem
already
to be. You're in?
Yep.
Well, it's not come up for me yet, so if it does come up, I'll post the charts. But otherwise, the deck of charts that we're referring to were sent to you earlier today.
I see the web, and I see Accelerate Alumni Conference Call, and Chair Petnell, and that's it, and then I don't see it for the slide.
Yeah, so I just it hasn't come up for me yet. My screen hasn't, so it may pop up, but I didn't want to hold off on starting the call.
Okay.
So if you want to refer to the other charts I sent to you.
Yes, I do. Yes.
Okay, perfect. So you can go and open that email, and then we can get started. So.
Yeah, I do have that slide open, you know, the PowerPoint slide.
You've got it open. Okay, perfect. Okay, so I'll turn the call over now to Mark, and he's going to be introducing Don.
Hello, Albert. How are you?
Good. I'm very honored to have to attend this call, you know.
Well, we're really pleased that you are on the call. So thank you for joining. Let me quickly introduce my colleague Don Margotta. Tonight's session is going to focus on mergers and acquisitions.
Yeah.
Don Margotta is our expert in mergers and acquisitions at Northeastern University. Don also has a technical background originally. His undergraduate degree was in engineering from Stevens Institute of Technology in New Jersey. He has an MBA from Rutgers next door and a PhD in finance from Chapel Hill in North Carolina, which is next to your IBM facility down there. So that's Don. He has done a lot of work in industry as well, and that includes being an expert witness in different sort of investigations in terms of if a valuation of a company is an appropriate valuation. And he also has experience in the back end of integrating acquisitions once made. So he'll talk about both the front end and the issues or challenges at the back end in terms of making these things successful. And all the while, we're interested in what the implications are for this in terms of both positioning IBM as a competitive force in the marketplace and also the opportunities that open up of selling into companies that are going through a merger. So with that said, what we should do is we should turn to the PowerPoint. I'll turn over to Don, and we'll get a feel for, you know, if you have particular areas you're really interested in, Albert, this is really your call, and so we can delve more deeply into those things that are most interesting to you.
No problem. Yep. Go ahead.
Albert, the charts are posted now on that web conference, so it's up to you which version you want to use.
Okay.
So, Albert, can you just introduce yourself very briefly, since it's just you, to Don, so he gets a sense of what clients you cover and what territories?
Actually, I'm based in Sydney, Australia, and I've been doing the Asia-Pacific Software Group as a leader of a premier technical team called TechWall. And I'm leading the team to provide the second level of tech sales support for the region. So that's my role.
And it's all vertical markets in that region,
yeah.
Correct, Albert? You cut across different industries.
I cover different industries, and I do have a team, an architect team, to specifically address the industry, so-called solution architect.
That's right.
Yeah.
So why don't you start, Don?
Okay. Albert, thanks for calling in. And this module was, the first part of it, was developed out of a course on mergers that I teach here at Northeastern and have been teaching for over 20 years. So the first six slides will give you some general facts and information regarding mergers that you may not be aware of. And then after that, we'll go into some specific software-related issues. Okay, so I'm going on to slide three. And asking a very basic question that I think a lot of people don't ask enough, and that is, why do companies merge? You know, in finance theory, we have a simple answer, and that is that firms merge in order to create value for the company, for the shareholders. But I want to throw it out to you because a lot of people kind of react not necessarily badly, but they say, gee, that seems too narrow. Do you think it's too narrow, and do you think there are other objectives of a merger?
I think it's the main reason, right? There must be some value, right? The value is a business of value. And strategic-wise, you know, maybe just looking for long-term, right? They must have the either short-term or long-term value. So,
all right.
I agree.
All right, great. This is not a quiz, by the way, but I was trying to get some discussion because a lot of people will talk, especially when you're talking about software, that an objective of a merger is to, you know, acquire technology or customers and so on. And I always like to stress that those other factors are strategies rather than objectives, and that you may have a strategy involving acquiring new technology and so on, but the ultimate objective is to use that to create value in the corporation. So no problem there. I am moving to the next slide, which really follows from this one, because it creates kind of a conflict. Because we say that mergers are done to create value, but the empirical evidence is very discouraging in that on average, acquiring companies lose about 2% of market value when they acquire another company. And on average, target companies gain about 40%. So certainly good for the target stockholders, but the acquiring companies' stockholders lose on average 2%. And that raises the question that if the object is to maximize the value of the firm, increase the value of the firm, why do companies persist in doing this if the averages are so poor? In fact, Peter Drucker claims that only 1 in 5 mergers work, while 2 in 5 are disastrous. And I don't know if you know Peter Drucker. He's a famous management consultant in the U.S. was a famous consultant. So
yeah, he wrote a lot of books. Yes,
he did indeed. He's a prolific writer. So it's pretty discouraging. And anytime I talk to students, and most of the students I have are anxious to go into investment banking or into companies to do mergers for a company, it's pretty discouraging. But I always urge them to remember that those statistics, like all statistics basically, they're averages, you know, and although on average firms may lose 2% of market value when they acquire another company,
Is it short-term or long-term?
Boy, that's the $600 question. let me come back to that for a moment. But the point I was going to make was that that those averages are made up of many companies that do very well in a merger and some companies that do very poorly. So on average, they're down 2%. So I always mention to people that that should not discourage you from doing mergers, but it should make you very cautious and make you check your numbers twice. Now, the short-term versus the long-term question. Boy, I wish this were a... I'm getting a lot of static. Are you?
Yes, a little bit.
Okay.
There was static on the back, in the background?
I think we're getting a little bit of cell phone feedback from Mr. Chong's line.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So anyway, the short-term, long-term, boy, I wish I had 10 hours to discuss that, because that is at the heart of many merger disputes. And let me just illustrate it for you. A company, Boston Scientific, acquired a company called Guidant, which makes stents for heart surgery. And the stock price dropped about 30% when they announced this. And the CEO came out and said, well, you know, the market is just irrational and is not looking at the long term. So that's the perspective of many corporate managers, if not most. And it comes into conflict with some things about finance theory. And I'm certainly not arguing that finance theory is correct on this point. In fact, I've argued against it. But let me tell you what the other side of the story is. Finance theorists argue that the markets are efficient, and they basically say there's not much difference between the long term and the short term because the market discounts all of the future cash flows. So all of the future, the long term, is shown in today's price. Now, that's a big pill to swallow, and I don't necessarily recommend it, but I just wanted to present the two sides of that story. And a more recent illustration of that is when Yahoo was selling at about $17 per share. Microsoft offered $30, almost double. And Yahoo rejected that. They rejected it because they said it wasn't enough. And Yahoo stockholders were outraged. But Yahoo directors and Jerry Yang, the CEO, said exactly what you said, that in the long term, he believed that Yahoo was worth more than Microsoft was offering. So you really opened the can of worms there. Okay. Was that all those points relatively clear?
You know, though, in terms of helping companies, Don, if the average success rate is at most 2 out of 5, and on average they lose value over what a period of time, then the question is, well, what does it take to make these things successful?
That's a great question, Mark. And
I'm sure. For example, I've been involved in acquisitions under the old BEA, which is now part of Oracle. Years ago, I met Jim Coleman, who was the founder and CEO, And his strategy was when BA would acquire a company, they would take the management team of that company, bring them back into corporate headquarters to learn the culture of the company, and then take one of the current executive team inside the company and put them out to manage the new quote-unquote division. Once the acquired founders came in and learned the culture of the parent company, when BA would not buy another company, they would be sent off to manage that business, so that there was this shifting of senior management talent to both bring in fresh blood, but also to learn the policies, culture, and preferences of the parent company. Another key thing that you see is the integration of IT systems. Some companies do it really, really well. Albert, you've seen this, and other companies do it so poorly that they never really straighten out their customer databases, their procurement systems, their back-end systems, and it just leads to a tangle of data. So this is where, Albert, I'm sure you've gone in with some of your accounts and helped them straighten out their IT in the event of a merger, and that saves over the long run the client a lot of time and a lot of money.
Well, I think the most disaster acquisition, as you know, is Mercedes-Benz and Chrysler. Right? That's a very good example.
Great example.
Yes.
A disaster, but a great example.
Yes, and then IBM has acquired the software company, and we can see some, it's great, you know, very helpful for the IBM software group portfolio, but the others, you know, not quite, you know. So I agree with you, the chance to make increase the value of the company is a great risk, you know. So we see that, and I agree with you. There's a lot of problem after the merger. Yeah.
Right. And so once again, you know, I'm not certainly not saying, you know, people shouldn't do this. In fact, my next slide indicates that merger activity in the U.S. is about $1 trillion per year, and in Western Europe, it's about $1 trillion a year also. I don't know what it is in Asia or the Asia Pacific, but it wouldn't surprise me if it was at least near that. So there's a lot of activity going on, and obviously there are a lot of optimistic people conducting mergers despite the empirical evidence. And I think Mark is exactly right that maybe the more interesting question is, why is it that those companies that do well, why did they do well compared to those companies that did not do well? So that's interesting research. Unfortunately, our finance people don't do much of that because we only look at stock price effects. But I nevertheless agree with Mark. I think it's very interesting and productive line of research.
Mark,
John,
can you hear me?
I just want to mention that a few other people have joined the call. So Abe is going to open up their lines as well. And I think we've got about 5 people on now.
Mark, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, Mark. This is Sunil Jain from Sydney, Australia. How are you?
Very good, Sunil. Good to hear you.
Okay. So, Mark, just a few comments. I mean, it's a very, very interesting discussion, and I just need some comments to make. So, first of all, as Albert said, you know, about the risks, you know, a lot of companies do not have a track record in mergers and acquisitions. I mean, many companies are doing mergers or acquisitions first time, and the market doesn't know, you know, whether they will have the capability to, I mean, the risk involved there, like whether they will be able to do the integration smoothly, or they will fail in, you know, product and their employee integration and their financial integration into the merged company. So I guess, like, I'm very interested in stock market, and I always know most of the time that if a company is acquiring another company, then most of the time the price for the acquired company will be much higher than their current stock price. So obviously, you know, the stock price for the acquired company increases straight away, maybe 20%, 30%, 40%, whatever. And the acquiring company, because it's spending money. It's spending money, people see that as expense, and we do not know whether that will succeed or not. So the price of the acquiring company invariably always or most of the time goes down. I mean, there are very few companies.
Always
like
happen, always happen in the first few days when the uncertainty rises.
Well, I mean, that's what I was trying to say, Albert, that companies like IBM, for example, who have a fantastic track record. I mean, we are actually masters of acquisitions. For IBM, it doesn't really matter. I mean, most of the companies will not discount IBM price because of an acquisition. But again, it depends on the price. So if we are going to acquire a $50 billion company or a $100 billion company, okay, there is a bigger risk than acquiring $1 million or $1 billion company. And the last comment I want to make, Mark, is that this is the current time. Credit crunch and financial instability is seeing, you know, a lot of mergers and acquisitions, particularly situations where the companies are not able to compete because of the cash flow problems, or in terms of banks, you know, smaller banks who do not have right credit rating compared to bigger banks. So they like to basically merge with the bigger banks, so they have a bigger, better credit rating, so they get they can get the money at cheaper rates, or, you know, survival, et cetera. And, you know, in some cases, we have seen, you know, J.P. Morgan acquiring, you know, that company, what is that, and Citibank acquiring another company. So all those things are happening. I think it's a fantastic time for cleaning up, and acquisition and merger activities are happening plenty. So I'm very interested to learn from you, Mark, what you have to say, but a very interesting topic.
Well, I admire your optimism about the current situation. But I want to make a couple of quick comments, Sunil, on what you said. First of all, you're exactly right about the target company. I mentioned perhaps before you came on the line that on average, target companies rise about 40% on average. But I've seen them go up as much as 200%. So there's a wide range. But on average, they go up about 40%. And the acquiring companies go down about 2%. And I understand what you meant about the acquiring company having expense when they acquire a company. But generally speaking, we don't look at that as an expense. We look at that as an investment, which is different because what they spend on an acquisition is all a balance sheet transaction. I don't want to get nitpicky on accounting issues, but it's a balance sheet issue. You may change your amount of debt on the balance sheet, the amount of equity on the balance sheet, depending on how you do the acquisition, but it's not an expense per se. And you might have just been speaking generally about that, but I did want to point that out.
Yeah. Mark, the reason I said expense, because if the merger succeeds, it's an investment. But if the merger fails, then it was not an investment. It was really a wastage of money, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
that's a good way of looking at it. It turns into an expense. It wasn't intended to.
Right.
Absolutely.
That's a very, very good point. Okay, well, actually, the next topic we're going on to is also one, Sunil, that you broached, and that is what is the value? How do you determine what a company is worth? And, you know, what kind of valuation methodologies do we have available? And typically, finance theorists look primarily at discounted cash flow. And I should also say that every investment bank does this also. I don't know of any professional who does not use discounted cash flow, which I'm not sure how much basic finance you all have had, but it's basically projecting the cash flows of a company out into the future and then trying to determine what the summation of those cash flows were today. That's called the present value of the company or the price. That's one methodology fraught with problems.
Go ahead.
You know, I was going to say, you know, you have a big problem in projecting the future, especially since you are projecting to infinity, which a lot of people are uncomfortable with, and you have the discount rate, which is also highly variable. But I'd like to mention something to you. Actually, I didn't mention this to the first class, but let me ask you, are you uncomfortable with projecting? I know you're all in sales, and I used to be a sales manager at one point in my life, and I know you always have to do projections of what your sales are going to be and so on. Would you be uncomfortable in projecting your sales to infinity? It's a joke, but
well, most people would be.
My colleague here, right, is very into software company. Well, if you consider a big company like IBM, you know, the software group we have is a $20 billion company versus a small company, right? The methodology you're talking here might not apply to IBM because anytime we acquire even a big like a Cognos, the effect to the entire software group earning and the sale is not tremendous, right? So we might need to consider, and this is a methodology, right? Cash flow, PE, whatever, you know, that can apply to most of the company. I agree with, you know. Cash flow, you see the short period of time, the cash flow will not looking good, but you can see the revenue-wise will increase, you know, based on the size of the acquisition, right? But several aspects, like I say, technology acquisition, market share acquisition, that revenue growth and also the skill growth, this is a multiple thing we can see, right? The skill, like I say, more than 10 years ago, we acquired Tivoli. We don't have that technology, but because of acquisition, IBM become a very strong system managing company. Now we are the number one in the world. So a lot of things have to consider, but some of you here can apply to most of the company.
I think I understood everything you said, but I think it changes the idea. I'll bet you that the people at IBM who do acquisitions, maybe in conjunction with investment bankers, I would bet a lot of money that they try to project the cash flows of the company they are acquiring. And, and all those things you said about what might happen in the future are very true, and it makes it very difficult. But people do it anyway. They have to do it. You know, you have to be comfortable with a great deal of uncertainty.
John, that's Paul Cooper. Can you actually hear me?
I can hear you fine.
Oh, okay, great. So obviously I've been plugged in. Paul Cooper from Sydney, Australia. Good to be on the call. With the shockwaves currently running through the world at the moment, you talk about investment bankers being engaged in these things, and certainly in the past they would have been. But do you believe that given that most of them are being fire sold at the moment or amalgamating or becoming parts of banks to take on board their capital and a variety of other things, do you believe that they're going to be part of the equation anymore? I mean, there are so many fire sales going on now at the moment where huge organizations are either being nationalized, in other words, we're socializing the losses. Some people took the actual profits, but now the taxpayers are socializing a lot of these losses. Organizations that were household names are now being fire sold for share prices that would not have been thought of a few months ago. Do you believe that that is going to have a massive change on the way that mergers and acquisitions happen for a start, and whether things like investment banks and the way it was done in the past where they were normally highly leveraged against debt and equity and those sorts of things, or is that going to change dramatically?
The short answer is I don't think so. But at the same time, I want to entirely agree with your overall comments about the financial area right now. And, you know, obviously I follow that closely, and I have a visceral interest also since I've owned stock in several of these companies that have gone under. But what's happened, what's going to be happening is that the investment banking arm of these companies – like Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns, they all had investment banking arms. I'll bet you, I'm certain, that those investment banking arms will become divisions of whatever company ends up taking them over. And it wasn't the investment bankers were not the problem. I mean, they create other problems, but they didn't create this. At least the M&A people didn't create the current problem. The current problem has to do with credit default swaps and high leverage in the investment activities of these banks, not in their merger advisory activity. So I think their merger advisory activity will continue. Now, the only impact that I see is that I suspect that companies who want to borrow money to complete an acquisition, and that includes most companies, they're probably going to have a more difficult time getting financing. So I think that's going to be the major impact that we see.
You agree? Yeah, I do agree with you, Mark. I do agree with you, yes. I think it's a greed, you know, greed to take over the discipline, the too much greed, and that caused this disaster so far.
No question about that. I think we all can agree on that. Okay, I wanted to complete this slide on number six because I talked about discounted cash flow and the difficulties involved with that. There are other methodologies that people use to value companies. They're kind of rules of thumb. And, for example, in the software industry, and these numbers are about, I think, 2 years old, but people have looked at price to revenue multiples of 2.5 and price earnings multiples of 30 times and so on. So let me throw a question now for a quick discussion. We'll move on. If you're valuing one company, presumably the company has only one value, would you expect a discounted cash flow analysis to come up with an answer on the value of a company similar to what a earnings multiple or other kind of comparable, as they're called, would come up with? Would you expect the numbers to be relatively equal?
Well, I believe it's not equal. I would say this is a very quantitative, because like a PE, you know, the IBM PE is very low, right? But you see that IBM today is more defensive in a disaster environment now. But acquisition, you look at the other side, you know, like I say, market share, technology, and skill for the company, and the more long term, you just can't see from it also only quantitative. If the company is small, this quantity measurement might indicate a more more truly the value. But for a big company, you know, I don't think so that would show much, you know, truly assessment.
Okay. I'd like to leave you on this with some numbers to illustrate the difficulty in this area. And it comes from a court case that I was involved in as an expert witness where a company called Internet.com, that's a great name for a company, but Internet.com was a spinoff from another company called Meckler Media. And basically what they did was one company, Penton, was acquiring Meckler Media, but Penton did not want the Internet.com piece. So they sold that to the CEO, and the former CEO. And they sold it for approximately $20 million. And the valuation was done on a discounted cash flow basis. About 4 years later, the CEO took that company public for about $400 million. So stockholders were very upset, and they sued the CEO and the company, arguing that at the time that he bought this for $20 million, which you get from discounted cash flow, if you had used a multiple of revenues for Internet-type companies at that time, they were selling for approximately 30 times revenue. and the company had annual revenue at the time of about $9.3 million. So the plaintiffs in this law case were valuing the company at approximately $280 million using a multiple, and the CEO was valuing the company at $20 million using discounted cash flow. So I don't want to go through all the details of it, but I think it's an illustration that should be a sobering thought to any of you who are involved in valuing a company and realizing that that there are a lot of there's a lot of variance in what you do, and you should always question people about their assumptions and so on.
Mark, how can people sue the CEO? Because I'm sure whatever method they used at that time, that went through the board of directors and then shareholders' approval. So basically the shareholders approved that at that time.
The shareholders did approve, but they argued that they were lied to, that they were given misinformation, and so on. So that was
So it really comes down to, did board of directors intentionally were hiding some facts, or this is what they genuinely thought, and what was the advice given to them by external consultants and other people who are involved in this kind of merger and acquisition activity? I mean, right?
Right. You're exactly right. But it was one of those, there's a lot of litigation like this. Valuation is probably the most litigated issue in corporate law. So, and again, I know we can go through a lot of details.
That's an interesting point, though. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I just wanted to illustrate how vastly different valuations can become if, under different methodologies, and just to raise your sensitivity to it as you're going through it. And maybe the very last comment on this is a deal very much in the news, and that is where Microsoft made an offer to buy Yahoo. Yahoo was selling in the market for about $17 a share. Microsoft offered 30. I think I might have mentioned this earlier, but it's relevant here too. So it was selling in the market at 17. Microsoft offered 30, and the board of directors of Yahoo rejected the 30, saying it was not high enough. So that kind of question raises all kinds of interesting issues, which unfortunately we don't have time to go into here, but in terms of what rights does the board have to reject this offer without letting the stockholders vote on it. In England, for example, I think they have to vote, and I'm not sure what it is in Australia, but it wouldn't surprise me if it's similar to what it is in England.
Mark, I have a little question, if that's okay with you.
Sure, please.
And the question pertains to current environment, because with the share market being so volatile, and last night again the Dow has gone down almost 500 points, it really is presenting a great opportunity for companies to acquire some really very well run and very well managed businesses, because many of the smaller companies or even medium sized companies right now are in dire state because they do not have cash, and it's becoming impossible to basically find cash at the right prices. Do you see lots and lots of acquisition happening in next couple of months?
Well, I think so, but the other side of that coin, while you're exactly right that a lot of companies are hurting, they don't have cash, but unfortunately the potential acquirers are in the same situation. So they don't have the cash to do the acquisition, and it's pretty tough to borrow money. But I think overall your point is very well taken. I think as soon as an opportunity arises, you're going to see some of these really bargain-based companies being acquired, and even some of these very good companies, maybe the best investment they can make is to buy back their own stock. I think we're going to see a lot of that. But
right.
Anyway, Mark, do you want to move on?
Hi, Don. Don, this is Rishi Mehtani from India. Hi, Mark. How are you doing?
Very good. Thank you for joining the call.
Wonderful. almost, but I missed the call yesterday night, but I didn't want to miss, although it was very early in the morning for me. So I have a question. Don, you were talking about discounted cash flows versus multiples for evaluating a company. So
yes.
Since there is so much of discrepancy between what you gave a very nice example of evaluating a company at 20 million while its value from a price revenue perspective was at 280 million. So what is it that a company would focus on, or what would be a better indicator of what the actual value is when you're acquiring?
Well, you know, the problem with all of these valuation methods, as I frequently tell my students, you know, if value is the discounted value of future cash flows, and if we can agree that nobody knows the future, we can then agree that nobody knows the value of a company. And it really then becomes, lots of estimates and you get into a lot of corporate governance issues regarding, well, given that nobody knows, who should make the decision? Should it be shareholders? Should it be the board? And so on, a topic perhaps for another day. But you make a very good point. But in the interest of time, I think we probably want to move on to the specific IBM issues in these slides. And the first one, which is slide 7, is when there are mergers, companies are faced with all kinds of integration issues, such as product integration, sales force integration, financial statements integration, and systems integration. And I just wanted to ask some discussion about what IBM products lead into that market.
So your question is here, how IBM, what contribution can IBM product make to resolve common module challenge?
Yeah, such as integration, product integration, Salesforce integration, and so on. Do you have IBM products that specifically address those issues?
Well, the software group might we have the Rational, right? Maybe we have that's for development. On system management-wise, we have the AAA. But I don't see, because we're not a very typical application company, so we may help the product integration, system integration, but I can't see if we can help the sales forces. Maybe in some way, maybe it has other comments.
So the sales force integration, for example, could be through collaboration, that Lotus collaboration.
Collaboration.
Software, wikis and blogs, finding the right people, through profiles, activities, So I think right now, Mark, I would say that IBM portfolio is a very rich portfolio which can really provide a lot of value to entities, and companies when they are merging in terms of product, in terms of Salesforce, financial and systems integration through, if we look at our five software group brands and the SOA story, it really fits in very well. And I think IBM company is very, much looking into this, and wherever we have holes, they are acquiring companies. One company every 15, 16 days. So, we are acquiring about 24, 25 companies in a year. And the market has really responded very well. So, they are not asking questions because our track record in acquiring and converting those companies into blue, blue washing, is a very, very good success story.
Great.
Sunil said, two key areas in an integration scenario which are very important is integrating the applications of the new company with the old company or having common applications. So we have a very, very solid integration story as Sunil touched upon SOA. And the second area is getting a customer single view across your entire enterprise. And we have a great offering in this as well. So these are two very important areas from an integration perspective that IBM provide the solution in.
Who does the integration planning? Is it your services group or the software group itself in terms of...
It's software group itself. We have a portfolio of products under the WebSphere brand, and they fall under software group itself.
And Mark, I would say this, that based on, I mean, if you look at any recent acquisition that IBM has made, you know, the day they really announce it, you know, they have a full acquisition team. In effect, IBM immediately appoint a person responsible for merger activity and in integration, you know, for integration efforts. And within most of the smaller companies, like up to maybe $50 million, if I want to put a number, you know, they are blue washed and integrated within almost about 2 weeks. It's a very, very, very fast turnaround. I mean, we have seen it recently, you know, and we have the other two things I would like to highlight here, which are really very important and part of IBM software group, particularly software group strategy for merger and acquisition integration, is the open story. You know, we have the open source and open strategy. So really, irrespective of, you know, if our customers who we are acquiring are already on open systems, you know, it's so easy to basically integrate, and so that's why we are talking about open strategy compared to, you know, companies like Microsoft who are on proprietary solution, because it becomes very, very difficult for them to acquire a new company, and then, you know, it will take longer time. That's one. The second is, you know, adoption of social software, for example, you know, and other newer technologies, Web 2.0. Is a great step ahead, and I think right now we have great interaction with the analyst community. They like our growth strategy, and they like our acquisition strategy, and IBM stock price has been going up and up. I mean, of course, of late, during last couple of months, today actually it's tracking at $96, which is not really I mean, we were at $130 a couple of months back, so but this is because of, you know, the overall financial situation that we are in with all of us and our customers. Big banks, of course, are not going to give us that much business as they were giving a few months back. So just these comments. Back to you.
Sure. My last comment on this area is to ask if you, and not really question, but just to throw it out, if you would ever consider looking at a database of ongoing mergers or potential mergers, and there are several databases available, of companies about to merge, and whether this would provide a list of potential sales leads for you if you have the products that help these companies overcome some of these merger challenges. So I'll just leave that with you and move on to the next slide, which is number 8, which is what effects on IBM sales do you see if customers merge? And that question emanated from an inquiry I had from a friend who is a sales manager for Iron Mountain Software in California. And he was terrified that, because Yahoo was his biggest customer, one of Iron Mountain's biggest customers, but his personally biggest customer. But Microsoft, apparently they don't sell anything to Microsoft, or very little. And he feared that if Microsoft took over Yahoo, that they would lose a very big customer. Is that something that's of any concern to you?
Yeah, it's similar concerns. One, from a structuring perspective, there are the way IBM structures the market is, we kind of divide it into a cluster and a GMB or SMB group. So if a cluster customer is acquiring a GMB SMB customer, that customer will move off to a different group and vice versa. So, yeah, concerns are similar.
And the next
so business as usual, you know, it happens on any acquisition.
Yes.
There's a win and loss. So
You're right. So, in other words, you may have a customer that is acquiring another company, and your sales might increase because that customer then will have greater need for your product. So there are two sides to that. So going to slide number nine, again, you'll have to forgive me because I don't know IBM's major competitors, but do you see any threats if current competitors were to merge and become even more formidable?
Yeah, Don, one of the biggest examples of this would be the Oracle-BA merger, where Oracle and BA have come together providing a fairly rich portfolio and filling in gaps in the Oracle Fusion portfolio around things like portal and integration and stuff. So yes, this is very, very relevant to IBM.
Okay. And getting toward the end here, and these are really just talking points and thinking points, but do you currently see any gaps in the product line that you sell that might be filled in by IBM?
As Sunil mentioned some time back, IBM continuously acquires company, and there are three or four different reasons why it does that. So one of the key reasons is to fill up gap in the product portfolio or get an offering which we don't offer today. So again, an example in that area, the latest one and one of the biggest acquisitions we made, Cognos, was a gap in our BI portfolio. And that acquisition has filled that gap, and we now have an end-to-end offering in the data warehouse space. So,
Paul Cooper here. It would depend if IBM made a fundamental shift into owning application software, for example, to say head off Oracle. He talks about the fact that they own middleware and application capability with their PeopleSoft and Siebel acquisition. So if IBM, say, made an acquisition of SAP, that potentially would be a game changer, maybe. But, it would be a fundamental shift in strategy if Steve Mills made that decision, along with the rest of the executive boards.
Right. Would that make IBM a stronger presence in that market?
Well, I think that, just depends on people's thought processes and that. I think that we're an exceptionally strong middleware company, probably the strongest in the world. Yet Oracle is doing exceptionally well, spoiling the fact that they have middleware and also the requisite business-based applications for organizations. So they are beginning to spend a lot more time talking to the business owners of organizations. And to some extent, I think IBM gets frozen out of those. So, locally here in Australia, they've recently signed a massive, massive deal with National Australia Bank to provide the new core banking systems for the bank. And, IBM tried exceptionally hard to, talk about the fact that we provide all the middleware associated technologies to tie the older platforms that they still have together with the new ones that they were going to be building out on. But Oracle convinced them also that they had the requisite middleware capability to do that, as well as provide the newer financial banking modules. Interesting. I don't know what our organization may do in that sense, but it is getting harder for us to sit in the boardrooms and sit in the business lines of business owners offices as a middleware provider.
That's a very good point, very relevant here in India as well.
Mark, yesterday.
That's one thing I want to point out. Two strong competitors merged together, doesn't necessarily become a more powerful competitor. But remember a few years ago, when Symantec acquired Veritas, one security company or one storage software company, but they give IBM a very good chance, and 1+1 is actually less than 2. So not necessarily true, right?
But I think I'm talking about, Albert, I'm talking about moving into the business application space.
I have to agree. I personally,
a security company versus a storage company, that's a set of middleware being purchased by one other company. I'm talking about us making a fundamental change.
The previous slide, you know, the two merger, you know, that's all nothing to do with your business, you know.
Paul, you made an excellent point. You know, I agree with you. You know, on a vertical basis, you know, Oracle and those companies present a good story. But having said that, you know, IBM is a much broader, having a much broader portfolio, including hardware, software, services, and financial side. And yesterday only, actually, in our management team, we were discussing about, because we are going to actually run a management meeting in Singapore next week, and we are looking at, you know, current environment where mergers and acquisitions are happening and what should we be doing in fourth quarter. And our thoughts were, I'll just put in 20 seconds, because companies are very cost conscious when these things are happening, and particularly from software group brand, you know, Symphony presents an excellent case, for example, where we are giving this free of cost to customers for productivity tools. Social software is another very, very good thing that we offer. And non-Microsoft Linux-based open office solution. So we have many, many good things. And on top of that, you know, IBM Global Financing can really help many companies, you know, right now in this environment. So we are, I personally feel very positive that we are very well positioned right now, even in this environment. And IBM is very financially very sound, even in this environment.
Well, that's
no disagreement there, so.
The next slide deals with the state of maturity of the software industry, and that is, you know, when companies mature as industries like banking, when one bank acquires another bank, typically the only thing they want is customers. They're not acquiring another bank for technology and so on. And when PeopleSoft acquired Oracle, it seemed clear that all they wanted was PeopleSoft's customers, not PeopleSoft technology. In fact, I believe they were going to convert PeopleSoft customers to Oracle. And I was wondering, in IBM's business, are the products you sell in that mature stage where things that you would buy, or if someone were to buy a division of IBM, that you are in a mature industry, or do you think you are in a technologically growing industry?
The answer would vary because of the broad nature of the business that we are in the middleware portfolio itself. IBM has offerings across a very vast span, across the five brands that we have. So I think it's very difficult to give a very simple answer to this question. It would vary from company to company and acquisition to acquisition.
Okay, I understand that, and I realize that all these questions are complex. I think it's something that we all should think about.
The market in the software-wise, I don't think it's mature yet. That's my comment. Okay. One thing is that we move from web 1.0 to web 2.0 very quickly. And you can expect we move to the web 3.0 very quickly too. And the other thing is a lot of middleware software today, right, we are moving to the business value. And this business value selling is very, I would say, you know, just started. And we can, there's no more than five companies that actually we call selling the business value. Oracle is one, essential in terms of integration and services is one. You know, IBM, I would say, also is one. You know, the Microsoft, you can't count it at all, you know. So there's the market is still a lot of room to move on, you know, and a lot of technology we can acquire, and this niche companies, more company can provide a lot of value. So I would say the market is still not mature yet.
Okay.
Yeah, and my comments are, Mark, that, you know, it's an ever-changing world we are living in. You know, technology is changing every day. So matured, you know, don't know what we mean by matured, but, you know, we are continuously changing. But I think in IBM, we are not just acquiring companies for the sake of customer base, but we are really creating a two-way traffic. You know, when we acquire, we are selling our stuff into their install base and selling their stuff into our existing install base, and which is actually creating a lot of momentum and a lot of new business every time we you know, acquire a company. And the last thing is, I mean, for example, we recently acquired this company called Nitix, and they have this SMB market kind of solution where we can give them productivity tools and messaging and collaboration. So while we are basically leveraging that and selling it to our small customers, we are selling to their install base, you know, our existing solution. So I think we have certainly a different way. We are not just acquiring for the install base and creating a two-way traffic.
Okay, great. That's a very good observation. The last...
Mark, it's Paul Cooper. I do apologize. I do have to go to another point.
We're ending right now.
Seems thought-provoking and very interesting, but I do have to drop off. My apologies.
Great. Thanks for joining
us.
Paul, thank you for joining.
Okay. No, thanks.
Okay, the last slide, and maybe, Mark, you might want to comment on this, because it's really a follow-on to that other comment about the maturing market. Mark, do you want to comment on that? That is, our web services not only changing design and delivery, but changing the way.
Sure, I can comment on this. Just very quickly. I agree with the comments made earlier that software itself, really good software, never matures. It keeps on evolving. So the whole notion of life cycles of software really doesn't apply because of the modular nature of things. So software always improves. That's why it's kind of fun. That's also why it's kind of messy. What does mature are business models for software. And so the whole age of large initial licensing for software and maintenance fees to follow. And then if you can, every couple of years to upgrade with another large license followed by maintenance, that whole business model, well, it started to come under threat at the low end with Google, and now people are thinking about at enterprise apps, web services, and a different business model for that, such as Salesforce. And so it may be, and with software, the real disruption is in business model, not that there's always disruption in the technology, but every once in a while, a decade or so, there's a disruptive business model. And that is the thing that we may be seeing with constrained IT budgets. You may be seeing this now in lower face amount software deals that you guys are bringing in. And so we may be at that sea change now. I'm not sure, but it certainly is a point of discussion and thought.
Okay. Mark, I don't have anything else.
Okay. Mark, did you want to make any comments to close the call, or I just wanted to make a few comments?
No, I just want to thank everybody for calling in from the other side of the world. It's always great to hear your voices again. I feel like getting on an airplane and visiting you all again, you know? It would take 3 months to do it, but it'd be a lot of fun.
I'd like to add my thanks to all of you for joining the discussion. I very much enjoyed it. So thank you.
And thank you, Don. You were great.
Mark, one comment that I really appreciate that you took AP into consideration and account. A lot of people just forget that we exist. So thank you very much for doing this in AP time.
Hey, listen. AP is where the action is. And
I
right
know.
Right now, there's just a lot of dust and smoke in New York City, for what it's worth.
Well, there's one thing I need to update you. China actually buy $200 billion of the bond from the $700 billion bailout.
Oh my! Thank God for China, I guess, huh?
$200 billion. You know, that's a few days ago.
Well,
so $700 billion 200 out of 700 is from China.
Let me be the first to thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay, bye.
And Pat.
So thank you for everyone for joining. I really do appreciate your attending and your participation. And Donna Mark, again, an excellent presentation. So thanks very much.
Just one comment. I think this was a great idea to do this call. And I think if we can, I know the attendance is fairly low in the two calls. I don't know about the first one that happened. But I think word of mouth will spread. And if we can do this on a periodic basis, it's very, very important.
And in future, you know, on top of what Rishi said, you know, in future, if you let me know and other people let us know, you know, who are the invitees in AP, you know, I can influence my teams, and similarly other people can influence their team, and we can probably get a bigger audience.
Yeah, excellent. And as we get more people through the Accelerate program, we'll have more attendees that have the opportunity. So that's really our goal. And as I was mentioning at the very beginning of the call, to Albert was on at the very beginning, you know, that's our objective, is to address some key business topics, and you know, to really you know, have discussions about some key element or some relevant topics to you that can help you in both your role as well as just understanding different perspectives. So you will be sent a little feedback.
Can I suggest a topic? I think one of the topics which is right there on the slide, which is showing, is web services, which is very relevant, very dynamic. Can that be one of the topics of, you know, what's happening in this area and how is it impacting?
Yeah, well, Mark and I can have a discussion about that, because we're going to come up with some topics for 2009, and then hopefully we'll run these on a quarterly basis. So
great.
Thank you very much.
Can we get a copy of this presentation that was shared? Can we?
Yeah, I did send it out earlier today, so it should be in your in-basket. And I will be sending out a notification with the replay number. So, again, you can extend this to other people on your team. So if they missed the call, please, you know, they're more than welcome to listen to the replay.
Sure. Pat, I have not got it. This is Rishi from India.
Rishi, I'll send it to you. I got it.
Oh, okay.
Pat?
Thanks a lot.
Yes?
Hey, Pat, one request that I have just before we hang up, Pat, is that in sending it out, maybe we can ask Don for one or two of his articles.
Sure.
That he can attach with the PowerPoint, and so that by the professor.
Okay, that'd be great. So I'll wait for that, and then I'll send everything out with the replay.
Very good.
Thanks very much.
Okay. Thank you all again.
Okay,
good night,
you.
Everybody.
Yeah.
Be well.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Yes. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.